I find Buddhism the most interesting and the most, I hate to admit this, but this is why we're going to do this.
Okay.
There's some confusing things about Buddhism. It's like, should I care or should I not care? Should I be present or not present? Where am I in all of this? And do I even matter? There's so much altruistic, but there's so much. What am I trying to say?
I think you're trying to say that when you're ordering a hot dog as a Buddhist, make me one with everything.
Thanks. Said the Australian news presenter when he was asking for a pizza or something. What was his name? That guy's funny. Rogue, I think, was his last name. Interesting guy. Anyway, Lama Sutra Malioni, she's the first American ordained Buddhist nun, and she joins us again on the Drew Marshall Show. Lama Sultram, so good to have you again. I remember last time you were on with Bob Thurman, and Bob had a very horrible telephone line. How's your telephone line?
I think it's fine.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yay! It's beautiful. Okay. I'm looking forward to a clear conversation. Do you know what I was kind of rambling on about before I introduced you, my confusion with Buddhism?
I heard it.
Have you ever heard anyone else say that kind of stuff?
I mean, I think those are all things that can be confusing.
Right. Well, can you help me clear it up, please? Okay, so if I was to invest time and energy and, you know, everything into your way of living, your way of life,
mm-hmm.
What would be like the first three things that you would introduce me to or get me to kind of understand a little bit?
I think the first thing I would talk to you about is motivation, and it's something called bodhicitta in Buddhism, and it means generating the motivation or the intention to do everything that you do for the benefit of all beings. So whether it's washing the dishes or driving your kids to school, you can always have an expansive motivation for whatever you're doing, and that would be based on a heartfelt intention to benefit all beings. So that would be the first thing I would talk to you about. And then I would talk to you about emptiness, which is the idea not that things are empty and that they don't exist or they're void, but they're empty of the concepts that we apply to them. For example, I am empty in a way of myself, because there's so many different ideas about me. You have an idea about me, my kids have an idea, I have my own idea about myself, and so on. But actually, when we look more deeply into that whole question of who am I, we can't find that solid me, that solid self inside. So we're empty of that idea of self that we have. Does that make sense?
Well, it does, and yet, you know, how does one actually practice that? So what I heard you say, if I could summarize it like a hockey player in Canada would,
okay.
I would say, all right, I have an idea of who I am. Other people have an idea of who I am.
Mm-hmm.
So where do I get my identity, my true identity from? Because my identity is skewed. Other people's identity is skewed. Where is my real identity? What is my real identity based in?
You don't have one.
See, this is where I my head hurts.
So maybe another way to put it would be that all these various ideas about oneself are illusory. In other words, even my idea about myself is illusory. It's based on various different things, like what I do, or how I look, or how old I am, or who I'm married to, and so on. So I think that the important part of this whole idea is that we aren't fixated on ourselves as solid, that we see our being, you know, that you're the Drew Marshall being, and that being is more like a river, like a stream, that's constantly changing. There, it appears to be the same, and the people will meet you tomorrow and call you the same name, but actually you will have changed because of impermanence over that night. And at a deeper level, that whole idea of yourself is more like a river, mm-hmm. than a solid thing.
Okay, so if I was to, again, rephrase it, you know, we grow as people. We grow as human beings. We are not the same as we were even yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair?
Yeah, yeah. And so why does that matter? It matters because we tend to solidify our world. We solidify others, objects, and so on, when actually everything is in a constant state of change. And when you break it down, whether yourself or a tree or the wall that I'm looking at right now, if we really break that down and unpack it, it breaks down to partless particles, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we know. We know that from science.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Molecules.
Yeah.
Okay, so the Buddha actually talked about that. He talked about molecules. He talked about partless particles through his experience in meditation. He had that ability to penetrate into what science penetrated into much later. And so if we have that understanding of our world, we have more sense of how things actually are than our illusory ideas about them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's called emptiness, and it is a little hard to understand, maybe, but it is also so profound when you understand it. So that's one thing. And you had asked me in the beginning what three things would I talk about. I think you asked for three.
Yes.
So the third one would be compassion.
So motivation, emptiness, and compassion.
Yeah, yeah. How's that sound?
I think that those are key principles for anybody in some sort of spiritual search. Even the emptiness, you know, even in the Christian world, you would say, you know, stuff like, well, when I am weak, he is strong. But I think, you know, as we contrasted the last time, where we were attempting to contrast sort of the difference between Christianity and Buddhism, there are some differences. And it does, I remember the guy we had on last time, Bruxy Cavey, was saying something like, it doesn't help anybody when we say, oh no, we just focus on the similarities. We get all kumbaya about these these world religions. And, you know, the reality is there are differences.
Yes.
And to paint over those and just go, no, it's all the same, it's all the blah, blah, blah. It doesn't, there's no respect there.
Mm-hmm.
To the actual belief. It detracts from the truth of each belief system, I think. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I understand the benefits of finding commonality.
Sure.
And I also think that it's important to penetrate the differences and to really make an attempt to understand them.
Lama Sultram, why are you Lama Sultram? Why did you become the first American ordained Buddhist nun? Why are you Buddhist?
Why am I Buddhist? Well, I met Buddhism very young. I was lucky. I met it when I was 19. And at first, I really didn't want to call myself a Buddhist. I felt like, well, would the Buddha have called himself a Buddhist?
Yeah. Same with Christ.
Yeah, that's another identity of which we're also empty. But I think the reason why I am is because I don't find any, I mean, this is one reason, I don't find a conflict between science and Buddhism. In fact, the Dalai Lama said, if science ever proved anything that wasn't already being taught in Buddhism, he would follow science, but that hadn't happened yet. So that's an interesting piece. The other thing for me is I really wanted a deep esoteric tradition. In other words, a tradition where people had reached realization in this life, not just that they became good people and maybe helped others and so on, which I'm not diminishing the benefits of that, but I wanted to enter into, to explore the depths of spiritual possibility that we have in a tradition that had done that. And so my teachers would have done that. And I didn't find that in the West. I was raised Unitarian, and it's a wonderful form of Christianity, I think. But what I really wanted was that wisdom that comes from years in solitary retreat or in the cave or in depth practices. And I found that in the Tibetan tradition. Tibet was really like a laboratory for spiritual development in the middle of Asia. One-third of the population were monastics, one-third. And the president was the Dalai Lama. So they really have a gift for the world, and I have a great appreciation for having met that when I did and been able to explore it as deeply as I have in this life.
All right. I'd like to try to just go back to the whys just a little bit more. I've always said to people, I'm more interested in why you believe more than what you believe. And that kind of, I guess I want to go back to sort of your entry point again. So was mm-hmm. there something missing? Did you have some personal trauma? I don't know. I think back to my conversion, if I could use that word, to Christianity, or when I decided that I wanted to get to know the teachings of Christ. And I was a teenager at a Christian camp, and I was sleep deprived, and it was Friday night, and they put the hit on me, and I knew if I bought into Jesus, I'd get an ice cream cone, and a girl would hug me. So my motivation at that point in time, I don't think was grounded necessarily in the purest search. There was a lot of peer pressure stuff happening. And so your search, why were you searching? Why couldn't you just be? Why did you have to buy into some tribal conditioning?
Some foreign tradition.
Especially foreign. Well, I guess back in those days, it's kind of like it's come full circle again. Anything that's foreign and esoteric has way more of a curbside value than mainstream stuff from North America, right? So,
it is an interesting question, and it is a question that my parents asked me. I was raised in New England, and both grandparents were PhDs from Harvard in philosophy, and so. I had a history in the sort of New England philosophy tradition, European and so on, but as I received it from my family and William James and so on. And do you know the book, The Varieties of Religious Experience?
No.
Yeah, William James. It's a well-known book about the variety of religious experience. But in any case, my mother came to visit me in India with that under her arm, saying, why isn't this enough? And for me, it really had to do with two things, I would say. One is just a felt sense of presence in the lamas, in the Tibetan lamas, that I had never experienced before.
Help me understand that a little bit more.
The level of blessing power, of peace, and of wisdom that came from them was, in my experience, something I could feel. I could sense it. Of course, they gave teachings and so on, but it was a feeling. And the other thing was, I think that I had previous karma with Tibet. And so when I met Tibetans, even though I was from New England and so on, that those seeds that were in my mind stream were activated. And I felt at home in a way that I had never felt at home before. I didn't have a difficult childhood. I had a happy family and I wasn't running from something, yeah. Wasn't traumatized. I was drawn towards something.
Interesting.
And it I believe had previous roots in my mind stream.
We are chatting with Lama Sultram Alioni. Did I say that right, first of all?
Yeah, you're doing very well.
Thank you. First American ordained Buddhist nun. How do you feel about that title?
First American
ordained Buddhist nun. First of all, is it accurate? Second of all, as a Buddhist, you should shun that kind of, moniker.
Well, I'm not a nun anymore. I was ordained in 1970 and was a nun for about 4 years, but I gave back my vows. So
hold on, you gave back your vows because you you liked a guy?
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yep.
I was the only Buddhist nun in America at that time, and I found it very difficult. You know, monasticism is usually practiced collectively in a group. And so I found it difficult to have that experience here, and I wanted to live in the West. It was easy when I was in India and in the Himalayas, but when I came back, it was difficult. And I wanted to have a family. And so I felt like if I had kept those vows of celibacy and monasticism and so on, that I would have been repressing something, and that that wouldn't have been good for me.
I concur.
You can relate?
I can relate, just a little bit, yeah. Yeah. Lama Sutram, please tell us about Terra Mandela, and please talk about Wisdom Rising, a journey into the Mandela of the Empowered Feminine, because you're talking to two dopey males here, so help us understand.
So my book, Wisdom Rising, in a way, it starts with a very wide panoramic focus coming into our situation that we find ourselves in now with women rising and standing up in ways that they haven't for a while. And we're finding that in the Women's March last year and then in Me Too and all the other kind of movements. Yeah, movements, I think, that are happening now. So there's a broad sort of view of the sociological situation in which I parallel the history of women and the history of nature and how the, I guess you could say, the fate of women and the fate of nature has been similar. When women have been used and abused, so has nature.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, if you
look at it. How did that penny not drop a long time ago? That makes total sense.
I don't know.
The countries that subjugate their women also rape the environment.
Yes, yes, yes. And so that is our world situation, and one of the things I talk about in the introduction is how religious values are so much more at the root of and the unspoken influence of our world situations. And the basic premise of all world religions is patriarchal, in which the religious experience is seen to be transcendent, that it's somehow out of this body, it's up, it's a masculine presence that is transcendent. And women in that paradigm and nature come out at the bottom. And women have been seen as an obstacle to that or not fully empowered by any means within those traditions. And so when we have exactly what you said, the abuse of nature, we also have the abuse of the feminine. So that's the sort of broad view that I begin with in the book, of tracking that and also statistically tracking it. And then moving into my own personal story of going to India at 19 and meeting the Tibetans and being ordained and meeting the mandala at that time, and exploring it. Now, the mandala, in case your listeners don't know, is a template of wholeness. It's the circle with four quadrants and a center. That template of wholeness was brought to the West by Dr. Carl Jung, the Swiss psychologist, and he found this in the early 20th century through Tibet, and recognized that this template of wholeness was manifesting in his clients, in his patients, when they would start to come out of a fragmented state into a state of wholeness. And they would dream mandalas, or they would begin to draw mandalas. And he himself Drew Mondelez. He was a commandant of a British prisoner of war camp that was in Switzerland between 1918 and 1919. And to keep his own sanity, and that's literally how he described it, he drew a mandala every day and then let that mandala talk to him, or he interfaced with it to understand his own state. So the mandala has been very important to me personally in its form as the Tibetan mandala. And so I talk in the book about what that is. And the five families are called the five Buddha families, the center and four directions, and their encumbered emotional pattern and the wisdom connected to each one, the color, the sound, and so on. And really develop an understanding of what those five families are. And then toward the end of the book, there's practices. There's meditation practices for the Dakini mandala. And the Dakinis are the female embodiments of fierce wisdom. But they are equal to Buddhas in Vajrayana tradition, the wisdom Dakinis. So it's the fierce feminine, but it's wise. So it's fierceness with compassion, which I saw when I saw the women's movement and the march and so on, and Me Too, that we need energy, that fierceness, and it needs to be informed by wisdom and compassion. And so that's basically what the book is about.
That was a great summary. It's almost as though you wrote the book. When it comes to the Me Too thing, and I'm going to be in trouble for calling it thing now. I'm just terrified. I'm like, it seems like every guy I talk to is walking around the planet not knowing what to say, what to do, or how to act. Mm-hmm. Anyway, aside from all that, when it comes to women standing up and empowering themselves and pushing back against patriarchal jerkiness, mm-hmm. Is there anything antithetical about that when it comes to the way of the Buddha? Because you guys, and I mean that in the nicest way, you guys are, you know, you're like the pacifist, right? You're like the, no, we're not gonna fight back. We're not gonna mm-hmm. even sort of stand up for ourselves. Is there any, I don't know.
That's not true.
No?
Because we have the, the Dakinis are fierce.
Well,
they're wrathful. So wrathful action would be differentiated from just being mad or being full of hatred. Wrathful action is like a mother bear standing up for her children.
Right.
It's fierceness without hatred. So Buddhism is not passive. It's active, but it's different to be able to manifest a wrathful energy, a fierceness that we saw, for example, in the Women's March. That's different than being full of hatred. Does that make sense?
Totally. So, totally. Even yeah. Tim, who is not really sharp, is writing stuff down
yep.
right now.
I like that fierceness yeah. without anger or type of thing.
Fierceness without hatred.
Sorry. Fierceness without hatred.
See?
No, because you know what? Jesus also said, in your anger, do not sin. So I guess it's kind of a similar...
Is it,
mind
though?
I know we're not supposed to make comparisons. We're supposed to revel in the differences and so on and so forth. But it is a common philosophy. Like, how do you fight back against the darkness?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's kind of...
You can manifest fierceness, but without hatred.
Yeah.
And that was a beautiful thing that I saw in the Women's March. There was a lot of fierceness, but there was also a lot of humor and joy, and there was no violence. There were 500 women and their allies marched on 7 different continents, and there was no violence reported in any of those marches, even though they were standing up and they were saying no, standing up for themselves and saying, you're not going to take our rights away, and so on. But there was also a kind of gentleness and humor and joy in it. which I found out such a good representation of the feminine. You know, there's been such a fear of angry women, which, yep. You know, and, oh, I'm not a feminist. I'm not angry. Don't worry. but that's been denied to women, that the fierceness. And we need to be allowed to have that aspect of yep. ourselves also, and to have it be effective. And so what I feel, and this is not to do entirely with fierceness, but that women, the feminine, has not actually reached its full potency. That it's sort of like lame or in some way wounded, and we don't even know what a fully empowered, and I like the word empowered, I-N-powered, mm. a woman would be. How would she manifest? You know, there's so much, so many years, so many thousands of years of oppression of women. It's hard for us to even know who we would be if we weren't growing up in patriarchy. We don't know that because none of us have.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's exciting to me to think of a fully, fully potentiated woman at the table in her female wisdom. In other words, not just trying to be like men or be as good as them or as strong or whatever, but to be in the feminine mm-hmm. and be at that table where decisions are being made.
Really well said. Now you know why she's been awarded the International Outstanding Woman in Buddhism Award by a panel of distinguished scholars and practitioners in Bangkok, Thailand. Her new book, Wisdom Rising, A Journey into the Mandala. By the way, I keep saying Mandala, like, because that's how we pronounce the band up here, but it's Mandala.
Mandala.
Yeah. Mandala, Mandala. Interesting how the word man is in that word. Of the Empowered Feminine is available now. And I want you to go to her website. Check her out. The website is Tara Mandala, Mandala.org. This has been a lesson in enunciation for me. This
pronunciation.
Pronunciation, yeah. Yeah.
You know, I'll be in Canada. I'm flying to Canada tomorrow.
You are not.
I am.
Where are you going, eh?
I'm going to Nova Scotia.
Oh, there's beauty people, eh? They are beauty. They are. Say hi to Nova Scotia for us.
I'm teaching a retreat in Cape Breton.
Cape Breton.
Yeah.
That's some of the best music in the world there, bye.
Go to Akali.
Go to Akali, yeah. You've been a pleasure to have on twice, Lama Sultram. Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Drew.
Yeah. Take care.
Lots of love to you.
Thank you. As you as well. Bye-bye. Bye. All right. I feel all... you hear how mellow I am right now?
Yeah, man.
I'm not high.
Oh, sorry.
I'm mellow.
Yeah, but you got to get your mandala on, bro.
I know.